Good evening, and welcome once again to Your Legal Rights on KALW 91.7 FM in San Francisco. I'm your host, Jeff Hayden. Joining me as tonight's co-host, courtesy of the San Jose office of Berliner Cohen, Josh Borger. By now well-known as a frequent guest on Your Legal Rights, Josh practices commercial and civil litigation in a variety of areas. Last November, we broadcast a show devoted to the law surrounding cryptocurrency. After looking at such questions as, where do I store it? How do I track it? If I lose my computer, can I find it? How do I value what my spouse might have stashed? And if I manage to find it, how do I value it? My guest pointed a picture of something resembling the Wild West.
Tonight we revisit that discussion. So just what has changed? Are these assets a form of money, a form of property, or are they securities?
As always, we're eager to hear what's on your mind and to answer your questions. Give us a call at 415-841-4134. Again, that's 415-841-4134 if you're in the Bay Area. If you're outside of the local dialing area, 866-798-8255. Again, that's 866-798-8255. As always, you can call regarding any question on tonight's topic or any question relating to cryptocurrency. You're not limited to the point we may be in our conversation. Again, that's 866-798-8255.
To help us sort out this regulatory scheme, we have with us San Jose attorney Chris Bossia, who served as a deputy district attorney in Contra Costa and Santa Clara counties, and is a staff attorney at the Northern California Innocence Project. He left the public sector and formed Bossia Legal, where he leads a team of attorneys and staff who zealously defend the criminally accused and both prosecute and defend civil cases.
And courtesy of Goodwin LLP, Grant Fondo, an experienced federal prosecutor and former assistant U.S. attorney in the Northern District of California, is head of the litigation departments for Goodwin's California offices, founder and co-chair of its digital currency and blockchain technology practice, and a partner in the firm's security litigation and white-collar defense group and its privacy and cybersecurity practice.
From the Palo Alto office of Perkins Coie, business attorney Troy Foster has focused on emerging companies for his entire career. He has particular depth representing technology startups, as well as the investment banks and venture capital firms that support them. Troy provides legal leadership for emerging growth businesses on all of their legal, compliance, and related matters, working with numerous mid to late stage emerging growth companies and pre-IPO candidates.
And finally, from the Palo Alto office of Cooley LLP, Patrick Gibbs focuses on securities class actions and derivative litigation, Securities and Exchange Commission investigations, and enforcement proceedings and internal corporate investigations. So to one and all, welcome to Your Legal Rights.
Thank you.
You know, before we get further into it, I think the simplest question I have to ask is, for a brief overview, just what is cryptocurrency? Blockchain, we hear about Bitcoin. Are these all the same thing? Troy, maybe you'd like to grab that one if you can.
Yeah, sure. So they're not all the same thing. Cryptocurrency is a digital asset that is really designed to be like a medium of exchange between kind of counterparties. The blockchain is sort of a distributed ledger technology for using a kind of a distributed network of computers to sort of track to sort of be a ledger of truth. And then, you know, Bitcoin is a type of cryptocurrency that is, you know, reasonably popular and in, you know, widespread use. Others include Ethereum, XRP, and Tether, I think, are the top current cryptocurrencies by usage.
Who controls Bitcoin?
Yeah, it's an interesting question. So no one and everyone. The way that you know these technologies are designed to work is through a consensus mechanism, right, of the sort of various sort of nodes on the network, and those nodes are just different computers that are distributed widely so that there's no centralized controller of that of that system. It's interesting though, the Bitcoin in particular has an interesting origin story, in the sense that the quote unquote founder of Bitcoin, and the person that probably still holds the most of it, is someone named Satoshi, not his real name, and nobody quite knows who that person is.
Grant, let me ask you this. We hear about centralized and decentralized blockchain. What does that exactly mean?
So sort of as it sounds, like a centralized is there's one entity, historically, like it's a bank or something, or a government, who controls whether it's the transactions, typically financial transactions. And so if it's a centralized blockchain, it's a blockchain that is controlled by one particular entity or a group of entities. Decentralized blockchain is a blockchain that nobody controls. It's basically, as Troy mentioned, there's nodes. So it's a bunch of, you know, literally thousands of computers validating transactions, for example, that nobody controls, and so that blockchain is decentralized.
So let's take a step back for a minute. I'd like to answer this one from about 10,000 feet, but we want to talk a little bit about how it differs from other forms of payment, whether it be a credit card or PayPal or even cash. But to really understand that, I'll toss this one, Troy, in your direction. Can you tell us a little bit about how it differs from these other forms? And just generally, tell us how it works.
Yeah, sure. So really the main difference is around, at least, you know, kind of currently, is around the sort of volatility, right? So when you are tracking, you know, Bitcoin, Ethereum, XRP, its value is not sort of pegged to, the U.S. dollar in a way that, when you sort of swipe your Visa card, right, those dollars, you know, are that credit is extended, right, but that's in U.S. dollars and it's sort of fixed. When people are, you know, transacting in Bitcoin, Ethereum, those units move over, but the value of those units, can be very volatile. That can make it difficult for it to really be a reliable medium of exchange because of the movements in the value of the currency itself.
What you're kind of describing, though, it sounds a lot like you're taking money out of the equation. And instead of dealing in dollars, it sounds almost like turning the technology back 100 years and trading in gold or silver. Is that really what this all comes down to?
I mean, that's an interesting way to think about it. But you don't have, instead of the hard assets, right? I mean, these assets are digital, and so there's no right. I mean, you hold them in an electronic wallet, right? You can mine them, right, by using your computing power, to kind of to create them essentially. But they do have that sort of flavor to them, right? Of the precious metals kind of analogy.
Jeff, I think I would agree with that. I think the key difference between Bitcoin and some of the methods of payment that you've described, like credit cards or PayPal, is that Bitcoin isn't really a method of payment. It is its own store of value or currency, which is why I think the precious metals example is actually quite a good one, because when you engage in a transaction with a credit card or PayPal, you're just using a different method to move government-sponsored currencies between two different people. When you're using cryptocurrencies, much like if you were trading in some kind of other asset, you're swapping that asset for a currency or for some other asset. But Troy's right. One of the challenges is it's very easy to figure out what a dollar is worth or how much you can convert a dollar into another government-backed currency. Cryptocurrency is a little bit more variable. But I think the key difference is there's government-backed currencies, which is what we're all used to using as money, and cryptocurrencies are designed in part to be used as a different type of money that's not backed by the government.
Let me follow up on that. In the U.S., the states cannot have their own currency. We've got one currency. And now we have this thing out there, cryptocurrency, that people are paying for items with in the United States, and it's not government-backed. How is that legal? And is that legal in every state?
Well, I think it's legal, but not everybody always agrees with me. I think there's no legal prohibition on using Bitcoin as a medium of exchange or some other cryptocurrency any more than there's a legal prohibition as a general matter on bartering one asset for another asset. I think the difficulty comes in not because it's either legal or illegal to transact in a cryptocurrency any more than it's legal or illegal inherently to transact in some other kind of asset. The challenge, I think, is and has been, how is it going to be regulated? And I think the question of how it's going to be regulated and who is going to regulate it has been the biggest challenge facing the development of blockchain technology and cryptocurrencies generally.
So I don't want to get too heady about this, but I had asked about whether it was closer to trading in gold or silver or something as we did 100 years ago. And the picture I'm getting, having heard from you, Troy, and you, Patrick, is that it's almost like the 100 years or 150 years of technology since those days seems to have brought us to a point where what we're really trading is the idea of an ounce of gold or an ounce of silver that's going off somewhere. This is an idea of this non-existent commodity. But in essence, it's been given real life.
Jeff, this is Chris Bossi. I think you're right on there. It's representative of value, just like a U.S. dollar is, right? There's nothing intrinsically valuable about the paper that the dollar is printed on. It represents some other value. It's traded in a market where people decide what it's worth, unlike gold. Gold and silver have intrinsic value, right? We see that historically. So in a strange turn of events, the people who set up these cryptocurrencies were desperately trying to get away from central banks that would regulate them. This Satoshi, the legendary Satoshi Nakamoto, he founded this thing based out of a distrust of central banks. And if you think about the time frame in which he did that, it made a lot of sense. You have a lot of inflation. You have politically driven decisions that central banks are making to prop up economies. And so Satoshi allegedly wanted to create this peer-to-peer network that would be free of regulation. But of course, there's a dark side to that. And it would be very interesting to talk about that tonight.
So in some levels, is this almost in competition with more traditional currencies and commodities?
Well, I think it's in competition, but it's really about, do people trust it? And it does represent a value. I mean, we've seen that wild roller coaster ride of that market. Is it going to be something that the majority of people on the planet trust in? Well, there's a number of countries in the world that ban it. So right off the bat, certain countries just have such a distrust that their rulers have decided we're not even going to allow this to be used in our country. Some countries in Southeast Asia and in the Middle East.
Well, Patrick was raising the issue, the interesting issue of, he said the complex issue is regulating it. Yeah, I guess you could view this as property. You could view it as a commodity that people are trading. People are much like IPOs. You hear about initial coin offerings that are using it, and that's when the SEC bells and whistles go. So what is this, according to the government?
I think the answer is every regulator thinks it's the thing that they regulate, right? So the SEC says it's a security. The IRS says if you receive it, it's income. And the Commodities and Futures Trading Commission says it's a commodity. So at least so far, that's been the answer from the regulators, is it's the thing we get to regulate.
And so everybody, whatever each one of them individually, each agency, if they want to regulate it for their benefit, they can regulate it any way they want, even if it contradicts a different agency. Anyone?
No, I would say that yes and no. I think they are. It's interesting. As this started to develop, you had industries actually competing against each other. Sorry, regulators competing against each other to kind of grab the headlines. They have put lines in the sand a little bit. Like the SEC will regulate only digital assets that they believe are securities. Now the question is, what is a security? There's a lot of disagreement in the industry and even amongst regulators and even within the commissioners of the SEC about what is a security and when, whether they should be regulating these things. So a lot of it's in the eye of the beholder. They have started to provide more guidance, and through court opinions and other actions have given some guardrails on this, but it's still a long way before we have really tight boxes about what a particular digital asset, which box it fits in. Other than the IRS, they tax everything. So that's the easy one.
Yeah, there's also been some evolution over time, right? So because the regulators were a little slow to it, some of the early cryptocurrencies that were arguably securities when they launched have now, you know, sort of gotten out of that status as securities. And the SEC has sort of acknowledged in at least a couple of cases that you know, yeah, they're not going to regulate Bitcoin as a security. I think they said the same thing about Ethereum. So, you know, the regulators are starting to catch up here, but for a long time, they were behind in terms of, you know, trying to figure out whether this was fish or fowl.
You're listening to Your Legal Rights on KALW 91.7 FM in San Francisco. I'm Jeff Hayden. Tonight, we're discussing the complex legal arena surrounding cryptocurrency with my co-host tonight, Josh Borger, and from the Palo Alto office of Cooley LLP, Patrick Gibbs, from the Palo Alto office of Perkins Coie LLP, Troy Foster, courtesy of Goodwin LLP, Grant Fondo, and San Jose attorney Chris Bassia, founder and managing attorney of Bassia Legal. If you have questions for my guests, our phone number is 415-841-4134. Again, that's 415-841-4134. If you're outside of our local dialing area, call us toll-free at 866-798-8255. Yes, we don't bear the risk, but we will pay the freight if you call us at 866-798-8255. As always, you can call regarding any question on tonight's topic or any question relating to cryptocurrency. You're not limited to the exact point we may be in our conversation. I do forget at times to mention that our attorney guests are not able to dispense precise legal advice. We don't have all of the facts relating to your situation, your case, if there is one. But we're happy to pass on the legal principles that may help guide you in your legal decision making. And again, our phone number is 415-841-4134 or toll-free 866-798-8255. You know, before we go on, it seems the next area we want to talk about is the reaction that maybe has driven some or all of the companies to leave the U.S. and operate offshore and why. But before we get there, can you tell us, a lot of listeners may not be entirely familiar with these cryptocurrencies. They may have heard the name Bitcoin and not quite be sure what it is. Can you tell us a little bit, if I were to decide to buy a little of it, what would my experience be like? How would I go about it? What would I go and do? How can I watch it, track it, and start with where I would go.
So this is great. I'm happy to take that one. There's, you know, for the average consumer, there's actually a number of different exchanges out there that are very consumer friendly. It's sort of like the E-Trade of digital currency. So Coinbase, Kraken, other companies. And so those are pretty user friendly. And they track your accounts, they help you for tax reasons, et cetera. So that's, as a consumer, someone actually called me about it today. As a consumer, that's where I would go. I would not try to do this by setting up your own wallet or anything like that.
So I do have a question that's been posed for us. Why can't I just make up my own currency? What makes Bitcoin and other cryptocurrencies legal?
Well, those are two different questions. So you know, in theory, if you wanted to write a white paper, generate sort of a community behind you, and kind of do the work of getting acceptance of that cryptocurrency, in theory, you could do your own version of Bitcoin. And then, you know, in terms of how that would be legal, I mean, that gets into the specifics of, you know, what it is that you've sort of created, and, you know, essentially whether people are purchasing it for investment purposes or as a medium of exchange.
Let me turn it over to Rob in San Francisco. Welcome to Your Legal Rights.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. So I do my taxes with TurboTax every year, and this year it asked about cryptocurrency, and I don't remember the specific question, but so if I don't own any yet, but if I did, would they tax me on what I had, or is it only taxed after you finish a transaction? How does that work?
This is great. I'm happy to take that. Obviously, talk to your tax advisor, but basically, it's not on the purchase of it, but just like a stock, for example, or a piece of property, once you sell it, the IRS wants to know if you made any money on it. And if you made money on it, then it's taxable.
Okay. All right. Well, thank you very much.
Rob, thanks for joining us in Your Legal Rights. Let me turn to Bill in Daly City.
Hello?
Bill, welcome. You're on the air.
Thank you. This touches on a topic a friend of mine brought up today. He owns a domain name, and it happens to be the same domain name for a cryptocurrency company in Germany, and they want to buy it from him. He is trying to find out if they are legitimate, and if so, you know, what their value might be. The name of the company is LightCurve, and they want .com. Right now they have .io, whatever that means. So I'm wondering if you know how to check the authenticity and, let's say, honesty of a cryptocurrency company.
So first, is anybody on air familiar with that company?
I'm not familiar with it, but I can tell you there are cautionary tales that abound about these companies defrauding people. Just today, there were some indictments announced against various companies, and some of these companies involve, one of them was a guy out of Florida named Thomas Giddy, and he basically was promising people that he had hundreds of millions of dollars under his control. But it was just a large Ponzi scheme. So you have to be very careful when you get invited to invest in something like this. Be very cautious and do your due diligence.
Is the only way to find out is to wait until they're brought into court?
Is there any place, any centralized place, where you could look for various brokers or various forms of cryptocurrency, and which ones are real and which ones aren't?
There are a couple of online resources. The one I'm thinking of, I think, is called CoinMarketCap. And I know there are others that I just don't know the names off the top of my head. But you'll be able to see, if it's a cryptocurrency that's sort of well known, then you'll be able to see that the market cap of it, sometimes you'll be able to see also recent trading activity. This is one where just probably a little bit of internet research off the top will give you a sense of whether it's worth investing in getting your attorney to do a little bit more work. But I don't think it would be advisable to wait for the indictments to come out. It's probably makes more sense to be proactive on that.
Okay. Well, thank you very much.
And Bill, if it hasn't been said, be proactive, but don't be proactive on your own. You really want to get some professional advice before you could be seen as an investor.
Right. Okay. Very good. Thank you.
Thank you for joining us in Your Legal Rights.
Okay.
So we were talking before about how a lot of these digital currency companies were leaving the U.S. and operating offshore. Is that a fair assessment? And why is that? What's happening here? Grant, what do you think?
It's definitely a fair assessment. There are so many companies that want to be in the U.S. because it's a great VC type market. It is obviously a great financial hub. There's just so many, and there's tons of excellent talent here. But what's keeping them back is the regulatory scene. So they see the SEC involved. They see the CFTC involved. They get concerned about, I want to build this project. I want to build this company, but I'm not sure where the guardrails there are, and it's super expensive. And it's risky. So they decide to go offshore to more crypto-friendly areas. Some of the areas are really, pretty nice, actually. So you've got, Switzerland, Bermuda, Malta, the Seychelles. So there's a lot of different areas. They all have different degrees of probably credibility, in a sense. But Singapore, too, Hong Kong, London, there's just a lot of different vibrant areas outside of the U.S. just because those areas are a little bit more crypto-friendly and a little bit more crypto-certain. Plus, Grant, the U.S. regulators are good.
Grant, I've been assured that the U.S. law is crystal clear and it's really easy to figure out whether or not you're a security. Are you telling me you don't think it's crystal clear?
It is just a little bit vague. That's all.
Let me ask you this. If it was really crystal clear, would I have four attorneys on this show? Josh, what do you think? Would we have all these people joining us if all this stuff was clear?
Well, I'm curious, being in California and California being California, we tend to do things a little differently. Does California regulate it? Is it easier to deal in cryptocurrency in California, or is it not regulated any differently in California?
Well, the interesting bill passed earlier this – or not, excuse me, introduced earlier this year was AB 1489. And it was called the Uniform Regulation of Virtual Currency Businesses Act. And it died in committee. It went absolutely nowhere. However, Governor Newsom on September 25th, he did sign into law the California Consumer Financial Protection Law. And in theory, this could be the beginnings of regulation of cryptocurrency. But as I reviewed it, it seems light on detail. But it does set up a division of consumer financial protection, which in theory can have a research arm to look at these emerging financial products like cryptocurrency. But it remains to be seen in California.
Does anybody agree with with my premise that the likelihood of regulation goes up the moment that legislators start being able to understand what it is we're speaking of? And as long as they don't understand it, they're going to sit to the sidelines and play it safe.
Say regulators?
The likelihood of legislators jumping in from the legislature, or for that matter, Congress, really goes up with the idea that they have some understanding of what we're talking about.
I think that's fair. I think there's been a fair amount of waiting to see before jumping in and passing statutes. I think that's why I was asking about the regulators, because I think they've taken the opposite approach. But legislators, yeah, I think they've been hesitant to write laws and pass laws before they know what's going on.
You're listening to Your Legal Rights. We'll be back right after this.
Support for KALW is provided by the Bar Association of San Francisco. If you live in San Francisco or Marin County, the Bar Association's lawyer referral service can arrange for you to meet with an attorney experienced in the area of law related to your situation. Call 415-989-1616 or visit sfbar.org for more information.
You're listening to Your Legal Rights on KALW 91.7. Tonight, we're discussing the complex legal arena surrounding cryptocurrency. Next week, we're going to have a very interesting show. We will be talking about the constitutional implications of the upcoming presidential election and all that that's going to mean to us. What will we know on election night? What happens if it's contested? Exactly where can all this go? That's next week on Your Legal Rights. But tonight, we're discussing the complex arena surrounding cryptocurrency with Patrick Gibbs from the Palo Alto office of Cooley LLP, and from Coy Perkins, attorney Troy Foster, from Goodwin LLP, Grant Fondo, and San Jose attorney Chris Bassia, of course, my co-host, Joshua Borger. If you have questions for my guests, our phone number is 415-841-4134. 415-841-4134. If you're outside of the local dialing area, 866-798-8255. That's 866-798-8255. As always, you can call regarding any question on tonight's topic or any question relating to cryptocurrency. You don't have to join us exactly at the spot we're in our conversation. You can do exactly what Jim is going to do. Jim from Berkeley, welcome to Your Legal Rights.
Hi, thanks. Well, first of all, I think it's funny the way you're all talking, like regulators are somehow like really bad or something. I think it's funny that they're in competition with each other to some extent and all that. But, you know, all these the financial shenanigans that go on that just rip off the common people all the time. You know, it's like regulators aren't necessarily evil compared to, you know, whatever else is going on here and keep us from getting ripped off. But my question gets back to something you were saying, like, so who makes these computers? How, like, who gives out the computers? You stopped the answer to that question about, like, what is this? What, how does this really happen? You mentioned these computers, but so who makes those and who controls that?
Well, before I let my guest answer you, Jim, I just want to make one thing a little more clear, and that is I didn't hear anybody joining in and saying that the regulators were bad per se. And I think we would all agree that the regulators at least attempt to protect us all, because what we're really dealing with is something from our last show that was described as the Wild West. And when you have regulators that may have an intention of doing good, but they're all coming in from different angles and different positions, makes it very difficult to do business in the world. And that reflects the current legal realities of where we are rather than reflecting the individual regulators. But who would like to follow up with the rest of Jim's question?
This is Patrick. I'll take a shot at it. I would start by saying I hope you never end up on the receiving end of a regulatory enforcement proceeding. You might change your mind about regulators. But on the question about the computers, what the creators of cryptocurrency are creating isn't hardware. It's not a computer. It's software. The people who mine cryptocurrencies are generally using their own computers, their own hardware, to do the mining. And mining is really just a word used for performing complex calculations on a computer, which is what you can do to earn cryptocurrency. But the whole thing runs, once it's set up and released, it runs automatically because it's software.
So it's like an open source software thing.
Yes.
That people can get.
That's okay. Exactly right. Yep.
That wasn't clear. Thank you. Alrighty, thank you very much. And anecdotally, I'm sure regulators can be terrible people and make bad cases, but, you know, that's not the point. So, and thank you for the other answer.
Hey Jim, okay. I used to be one of those regulators. So.
Yeah, to the extent any regulators are listening, this is Troy Foster. I'm a big fan of regulators, so I'll just put that out there.
Jim, listen,
good night, everyone. Thank you.
To go to your point, Jim, part of it is what the industry is looking for is guidance. And that's, and there's been a lot more guidance over the last few years. The regulators have become much, much more knowledgeable. And part of the problem is this industry moves so fast, it's hard for people to keep up. I think, you know, to go to some other, like Patrick's point, et cetera, I think the more we could put up the guardrails by guidance rather than enforcement, I think, people would be happier. That's part of what I think people are saying.
Ultimately, the more consistent things get, the more that these regulators know the part of the market that they're regulating as opposed to the next, the more likely that things will harmonize and everybody will join hands, sing kumbaya, and we'll all be happier campers. But let's move on. I think Jim has moved on.
Well, let me ask it this way. If it's becoming more mainstream, are there things that you still cannot buy using cryptocurrency? Does someone have to accept your cryptocurrency? Can I pay my mortgage in cryptocurrency? What are the boundaries at this point?
I would say that there's a limit to what you can spend cryptocurrency on. You can't make anybody accept cryptocurrency. And there are, you know, the most of what you do in daily life, you can't use cryptocurrency for. I was joking with somebody today about paying my taxes in cryptocurrency because they're going to be filed tomorrow. But you can't do that either, just to be clear. Right now, its use is actually fairly limited. And I think that is in part because the regulatory environment has made it very difficult to get cryptocurrencies started and get them rolling in the U.S.
Well, could I pay an employee if my employee was okay with it in cryptocurrency?
I think so. I know some companies that do.
Yeah, you can't. So it's interesting that that's minimum wage here in California is required to be paid in cash. However, you can provide crypto as a sort of an employee benefit above and beyond the minimum wage. And if you have consultants, you could compensate them. You can agree in the consulting agreement, right, that they'll receive crypto, right, as part of the, or maybe exclusively, right, as their compensation. It's just there's the volatility associated with most of these cryptos make it a real challenge. I have a colleague that used an entire Bitcoin to buy a pizza when it first came out. And, 12 years later, she could have used that to buy a Buick. So, it's tough to spend it in that way when you've got that kind of volatility.
Let me turn it to Ron from Los Altos. Ron, welcome to Your Legal Rights.
Well, thank you. So, one comment very quickly, miners of cryptocurrency are leaving the U.S. quite simply because of the incredible amount of energy it takes to mine cryptocurrency. So they're going to places like Iceland, where they use the heat from the computers, or use the ice from Iceland to to cool the computers, which is where a lot of the energy goes to. And then they use the heat from the computers to provide to the Icelanders as heat. My question is, Jeff, Josh, would you accept cryptocurrency for your services, or would any of your guests accept cryptocurrency? And I ask this because I've seen this, I've seen some law firms actually say, yeah, we accept cryptocurrency.
You know, Ron, I've been offered even a flight in a small plane as payment for services. So I would be,
up on that one.
I think I just might. I'll give him a call when the show's over. Josh, how do you feel about that? Would you take the, Bitcoin, for example, for your services?
It's probably up to the managing partner. I'll get back to you on that one.
Would you take a flight in a plane for your services?
No, I'd have to pay taxes on it. No, I wouldn't accept Bitcoin.
Ron, there are a number of firms that take it. So, like, my firm takes digital currency, Bitcoin, for fees. So there are firms that do it.
Yeah, we take some as well, and I'm sure if you wanted to make a contribution during the next pledge drive, KALW would accept that as well.
I happen to know that Ron's question. Already gone down that road with us, but
follow up question: what kind of procedures or protections you put in place for that?
In terms of
those who do accept digital currencies, what kind of procedures and protections for yourselves and your clients do you put in place for accepting crypto digital currencies?
Well, I don't think I'm giving away any sort of secret sauce here, but I think on our side, we accept it only for some portion of the fees, right? Not the entire bill. It's you know, you can pay a portion of your fees in an accepted cryptocurrency, and I think we, as a rule, you know, immediately turn that into cash versus you know, kind of holding it, because it is, you know, intended to be a currency, not an investment.
Does anybody else have something to add to that? Perhaps you've had experience with accepting cryptocurrency for fees.
Yeah, there's usually a KYC process associated with it. So validating who is sending it, where it's coming from, et cetera. So pretty typical for financial transactions.
Well, thank you very much.
Ron, thanks for calling on Your Legal Rights, and I'll call that pilot in the next hour or so.
Yeah, be my guest. Take
care. And let me turn it to our next caller, who is Hank from Santa Cruz. Welcome to Your Legal Rights.
Hello. Thank you for taking my call. I wanted to impose some information on the assumption that Satoshi Nakamoto exists as an actual human being. Research, especially done by Adam L. Pinnenberg and FastCompany.com, with an article dated 10/11/2011, October 11th, 2011, indicates that through his research, there are actual three individuals that have the patent for Bitcoin, and they all come from Germany. At least two out of the three do. And Germany, as you acknowledged, is one of the main countries that actually recognizes Bitcoin as a transaction medium. So I was just wondering, you're all attorneys, but are you aware of the fact that Satoshi Nakamoto is a fictional entity, more likely an amalgam of different personalities that joined together to create the patent? And I could give you the patent number if you wanted as well, and the name of these individuals. The three that I'm reading about are Neil J. King from Munich, Germany, Charles Bry, also resides in Munich, and Vladimir Oxman, who lives in the U.S. and has several patents. But they all joined together to be named on the patent, which is updating and distributing encryption keys, number 201-000-42841, and contention access to a communication medium and communications network, number 20090196306. So I was just wondering, why would anyone believe that Satoshi is an actual human being when there's been no public disclosure, interviews, photos of this individual? And also the fact that Bitcoin, from its inception, was designed for those who wanted to patronize the Silk Road dark web website for transactions of illegal goods and commerce, whether it be narcotics, whether it be child pornography, etc. The intent and purpose of Bitcoin was to allow for the economic exchange of illicit material. So I guess I'm just sort of flabbergasted why it's getting the sort of cover of being a respectable medium of commerce.
Okay, Hank, I have to cut you off because we're almost out of time. And I do want to give our guest a chance to answer. But in short summary, what Hank has basically said is that Bitcoin or blockchain was invented by a William Shakespeare, if you will. We all think of it as one person, but what do we really know about him? Anybody care to take that one on? Just grabbing at random, Troy, you seem to have the expression that you're ready to go on this one.
Well, you know, what I would say is that, you know, people like a good mystery, and the sort of uncertainty around it has been part of the mystique, if you will. And yeah, you know, I think we're aware of the of the patent. I think I saw the Fast Company story when it came out, but I don't think that I don't think that's sort of definitive proof that those three individuals are sort of the amalgam or that the person doesn't have some other identity, right? Like I think there's still a fair amount of uncertainty there. And I've actually seen some litigation over, others sort of claiming to be Satoshi. My view on that is that the jury's still out. Look, in terms of the origin and the history of it, a lot, there's some truth to what you've said, absolutely. But at the same time, the fact is now that it is in widespread usage. That's not the sort of stuff that's happening, with respect to the dark web and Silk Road. Although I think Silk Road's been shut down. I don't think that that's the majority of what's happening with Bitcoin today. Like I think most of the people on this call probably own Bitcoin, at least some of it. And I don't think that we're engaged in any of those activities. So I think it is, moving to, what is a more mainstream usage today.
And as one would say, whether Shakespeare was an individual or collaborative, it really doesn't matter in the scheme of things. We're looking at this huge body of work that was really quite spectacular that people have been listening to and watching for hundreds of years, and we'll leave it at that as we're out of time. But I wanted to give each of you about 2 minutes each for any closing thoughts, anything you want to add. Who would like to go next? Patrick.
I would just want to leave people with the thought that I think that cryptocurrency, although it's very interesting and it's gotten a lot of attention because people speculate in it and people have made and lost lots of money in it. To me, the more interesting aspect of all of this stuff is the underlying blockchain technology and what you can do with blockchain and the software that supports blockchain, because I think it has the potential to change the way we do a lot of things in ways that could be very beneficial. And cryptocurrency itself is, to my mind, kind of secondary to the actual technology story here, which I think is about the blockchain.
Troy, would you like to take about 2 minutes to give us any closing thoughts? Anything you want to add?
Yeah, I mean, Patrick makes a good point, and I think it's the right one. I mean, I think if you, the cryptocurrency is a small ish sector of the larger, distributed ledger technology, ecosystem. It's an important piece of it, but I think the DLT technology has application, kind of beyond cryptocurrencies. I think you had mentioned your show next week is going to talk about the election and things like that. There's really interesting, distributed ledger technology application in voting and things like that, right? And so that I think is ultimately going to be the when the story's written, that's ultimately going to be the bigger piece of it is, kind of looking at that technology becoming more widespread through our lives.
Who'd like to go next? Grant, take about 2 to 3 minutes for any closing thoughts.
Yeah, I think it's here to stay. It is truly an amazing set of different technology sort of derivations. It is, for those of us who are involved in the space, the amount of energy and excitement and brain power that is dedicated to the space is really amazing. And so it's fun to be a part of it. And, you get a lot of smart, energetic, many young people, but there's a lot more suits now than when we first got into the area. But there's going to be a lot of good things that happen. And the way this technology and its uses have changed over just the last 6 years since I've been involved in the space is amazing. And so it's impossible to predict where it's going, but I think it's continuing to go somewhere fast and positive.
Chris, any closing or any thoughts you have, anything you want to add?
Thanks, Jeff. we didn't get a chance to get into it too much tonight, but there is a dark side to this that has to be noted for listeners. There's a lot of fraud out there, and we're very lucky in the Silicon Valley that we have a special joint federal, state, and local task force called REACT. It's the Regional Enforcement Allied Computer Team. I was involved in a case where I represented an individual this year who was the victim of $1 million worth of Bitcoin hack. And we were able to get that back for him. But it really relied on these specialized law enforcement officers to trace the money. And what I would encourage your listeners to do is if they feel like they are a victim of fraud or of a cell phone hack in which they lost Bitcoin, not only to call the police, but to go on the REACT website and to call your exchange immediately to put a hold on the account, but also to get the tracing going. Because one of the most attractive features of Bitcoin is how easy it is to launder, and it can get filtered to make it very difficult to trace, even with the great blockchain open technology. So just be cautious.
You know, each of you took a little less time than I expected to close, so we have a little bit of extra time. But we also have a lot of unanswered questions. So I'm going to ask you some really, really broad questions that we started out with tonight that might give us an idea for the next show on this topic, because I don't think we've really put to rest all of the questions. Last November, we were looking at such things as, where do I store this stuff? What happens if I lose my computer? How do I track this stuff? What if my spouse has stashed some money here? If I could find it, how can I value it? And that was the picture of the Wild West. Why don't you collectively take about 3 minutes and tell me why it's not the Wild West? Do we have answers to some of these questions?
Well, I'd say just remember, your cryptocurrency is stored somewhere, just like your money is stored in your wallet. And if you lose your wallet, it can be very hard to get it back. So you got to be very careful. People have these things called recovery seeds. They're 12 words that help them remember how to access their cryptocurrency. A lot of people write them down. I was recently involved with a case where a guy put his recovery seed accidentally into the McDonald's bag before throwing it out. So you got to be very, very careful. You do not lose that information.
What if your spouse were to be buying some cryptocurrency? It doesn't even have to be hidden. You are going your separate ways. You need to value assets. You don't want to divide it up. How do you put a present day value on this investment or this cryptocurrency that perhaps is used as an investment? Troy?
Yeah, I think it's a couple of things, right? So one is make sure that your divorce lawyer understands crypto, because if they don't, then that could be mishandled in the separation proceedings. The other thing is depending on what the crypto is, there are these various sort of exchanges that you can go on, which will give you quotes of where the value is on any particular day. By going to the website for the exchange, you can get a kind of a daily value on that at any particular point in time. It's interesting, going back to the volatility point I was making earlier, when we're doing transactions that involve these kinds of currencies, typically what we will do is peg the valuation to an average over a series of days versus any individual day, because of the spikes and drops in volatility, might give you on a particular day, right, you might not be getting a true picture of the value. Those spikes and dips may happen for reasons that are unrelated to what's happening with the asset itself. Could be things in the larger economy, things that are
that are one-time events. So that would be where I would go to make sure that you're tracking the value of those assets.
So it sounds as though things are settling a bit. Josh, anything you want to add at the end?
Well, if there's anything somebody wants to tell us about the future of cryptocurrency that they haven't already addressed, whether in 10 years you think it's going to be completely mainstream or where we're going to end up, it seems that people are agreeing it's getting more and more commonplace. If anyone wants to end on that, that'd be an interesting note. Predictions of where you think we'll be.
Take about 30 seconds if anybody wants to end on that note.
God, it's hard to predict past November 3rd at this point. But my expectation is that it will continue to get more mainstream, right? I mean, we're seeing, you know, there've been a number of sort of crypto ETFs that people have taken a shot at, venture capitalists are, you know, getting more and more interested in the space. I think that it's going to continue to become more mainstream over time.
Grant, you looked ready. Do you want to jump in for about 30 seconds or less?
Yeah, I was just going to say, just look at the news. You see China's got its own digital coin. You see regulators like the talking about, you know, the Fed talking about a potential digital coin. I think it's a long time away, but the nature of the conversations indicate that governments understand this is a technology that is here to stay. Business understands that, banks understand that, and they're all trying to figure out how to best apply it in a safe and legal manner.
You've been listening to Your Legal Rights on KALW 91.7 FM in San Francisco. Tonight, we've revisited our discussion of cryptocurrency. Our guests tonight have been San Jose attorney Chris Basquiat, founder and managing attorney at Basquiat Legal, courtesy of Goodwin LLP, Grant Fondo, and from the Palo Alto office of Perkins Coie LLP, business attorney Troy Foster, and from the Palo Alto office of Goodwin LLP, Patrick Gibbs, and joining me tonight as co-host, courtesy of the San Jose office of Berliner Cohen, Josh Borger. We'll be back next week at our new time again at 6 o'clock, a program you won't want to miss, as we'll discuss the constitutional implications of the 2020 election, just what happens if this election is in dispute, and how it will be dealt with. Our show tonight has been produced by Josh Borger, and I would once again thank you, Josh, and thank each of our guests. And our thanks to you, all of you, for joining us tonight. At the controls, Debbie Kennedy. I'm Jeff Hayden. Good night, stay safe, and have a good night.
Support for KLW is provided by the Bar Association of San Francisco. If you live in San Francisco or Marin County, the Bar Association's Lawyer Referral Service can arrange for you to meet with an attorney experienced in the area of law that is related to your situation. Call 415-989-1616 or visit sfbar.org for more information.